Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we have an occasional theme on American Variety that I call genderology. And the idea is to look in a light kind of way at differences between the genders and changing relations between them. Or I guess now you might have to say among the various genders. So along these lines, a few years back I did a show called The Shrinking Man, in which my guests were an anthropology professor and an expert on advertising. And we talked then about the changing image of men on TV in both programs and ads, from being, you know, in the past strong, competent, and in charge, toward being weak, inept, and foolish, with, you know, actually women generally being more in control in those shows and ads. And that drew a lot of response from listeners, many of whom had noticed the same trend. My guest today is Professor Elwood Watson, who teaches history at East Tennessee State University, and is a prolific author of books and articles on gender, African-American history, and American popular culture. One of his books a while back is an anthology of scholarly essays that's titled Performing American Masculinities, the 21st Century Man in Popular Culture. And that's what we're going to talk with him about today. It's a complicated and really kind of controversial subject in some ways. So listeners, here's your warning. Buckle up. Well, welcome, Dr. Watson. I presume we can call you Elwood.
Yes, you can.
Good to have you on. And so one of the main themes in your book is that gender, and in particular masculinity, is not a fixed and unchanging identity in an individual male person, but is a constantly shifting, changing element of one's persona that's pushed and pulled by changing economic and social circumstances. So, you know, assuming I got that more or less right, can you elaborate some on that theme?
Gender is not a fixed, unchanging identity. Gender is an entity that is quite fluid. As you just mentioned, it is constantly changing, evolving, transforming, however you want to define it. And there is no one way to define masculinity.
Yeah, so I've, you know, just speaking for myself, I've always felt male from, you know, my earliest memory, really. But speaking personally, I can remember many changes over my lifetime in my sense of my maleness, you know, obviously beginning especially at puberty and continuing through young adulthood in particular. I guess it was a function probably of testosterone levels, to be sure, but also was reflected in how successful or confident or well-adjusted I felt or didn't feel as the circumstances of my life changed in those early years. And I think my core personality stayed the same, but my outward expression of it changed over time and sometimes would change even daily in earlier times. So I would imagine that's true of everybody, both men and women. Yeah, so, you know, is that something that you've seen in your research or that you've read in other scholarly things, that that's, you know, it's kind of a natural thing, that that fluidity is something that everybody kind of recognizes at a certain point and just, you know, deals with that fluidity in your change. You know, we're talking here about men in this show. So in your sense of masculinity, it can kind of almost range from A to Z, really, I think.
Yes, we all have different life experiences. However, I do agree with you that masculinity and the issues of fluidity and a diverse set of experiences are a natural part of growing up.
I would imagine that the intensity of it changes normally, you know, speaking generally of, you know, populations as a whole, that I would imagine the period, like I mentioned, between puberty and maybe early adulthood, those kinds of things are more in flux. And then as you get older, they tend to get a little more, I want to say ossified, a little more fixed, or, you know, where the changeability is less frequent or less intense. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I would say during your teenage years, for most boys, or rather many, there is peer pressure. There is the assumption that you have to be manly. Don't show any type of emotion or any signs of perceived weakness. Otherwise, you're not seen as cool, and you're probably seen as less than desirable to be part of the alpha male club.
Mm-hmm.
This does not mean all young men ascribe to these values. However, I would say more than a few do so.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably generally true that peer pressure and so on keeps people in the teenage years kind of marshaled into the middle of the mainstream or the middle of the bell curve a lot, but probably less so than it used to be. I would say that the shifting and changeable nature of masculine identity isn't something that's just manifested in individuals. I think it's a society-wide phenomenon, too. You know, I assume you'd agree that, you know, for all the previous, 250,000 years or so of human history, it's been taken as an unquestioned fact that there are two genders, male and female, determined by biology at birth. And there were, of course, you know, homosexuals of both genders and transvestites in every culture, really. But I think, as far as I know, their gender wasn't in question. And so beginning in mid-20th century, though, you know, in the West, a few people who could afford it were surgically reassigned, meaning that some structural changes in their external parts were made medically. But even then, it wasn't generally thought that their actual gender had changed. But over the past decade or so, the idea that gender is something that you can choose has taken hold in popular culture in the West in particular. And so now we, quote, identify as male or female or non-binary or cisgendered or intersex, you know, all these new terms, or maybe another of the letters in the expanding acronym of LGBTQIA+. And I have to kind of think what those all mean. But I think actually those acronyms, those letters mix gender identity with sexual preferences. So it's kind of a letter salad there. But terms like gender fluid and gender neutral and transgender are now heard. And the idea of gender dysphoria has become accepted as a psychological condition where the person's inner sense of self doesn't match the biological body they were born into. And, you know, and also it's becoming common in academic and other forward-thinking circles to display your preferred pronouns after your signature in emails and other communications. I imagine we've all seen that by now, and there's beginning to be some disapproval if you don't do that. So what do you think, Elwood, accounts for this sudden shift, historically speaking, from, you know, almost absolute abhorrence of any deviation from heterosexuality to what we see today, which is an increasing acceptance and even insistence on choice in matters of gender?
As we said earlier in the conversation, things have evolved and society as a whole has evolved, and people are much more willing to embrace their inner self. 35, 40, a half a century ago, you had people like Christine Jurgensen, who in the 1960s got a sex change, or what we would call a transgender today. So even at that time, there were a few individuals who were transgendered. It was just not talked about as much in the mainstream. As the internet, social media, relaxing of social and cultural norms have evolved, society and other individuals have decided to embrace what they feel are their true selves.
Yeah, I think, like you say, it was, you know, I kind of vaguely remember those names from, you know, when I was a kid. And I think at the time you had to go to Sweden or something and pay, you know, some humongous amount of money to have that reassignment surgery done. And it was just very rare for those reasons, right? But a lot of things have changed since then. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Professor Elwood Watson about masculinity in America, really, and how it's evolved over the decades from, let's say, the 50s until now, which is, you know, spanning a period of 70 years, really, so better part of a century. He's written a book called Performing American Masculinities, The 21st Century Man in Popular Culture. Well, Elwood, let's talk, maybe you mentioned the media and the internet a minute ago, so let's talk about the influence of the media. I mean, on TV throughout the 1950s and through the 70s, men were typified by, you know, like Father Knows Best and Perry Mason types who were, you know, strong and calmly in charge. But that began to change really pretty quickly with shows like All in the Family and Three's Company and many others. And at the same time, in shows like Laverne and Shirley and The Mary Tyler Moore Show, women began to be portrayed as more independent and outspoken and not just the passive mother and housewife and homemaker. You know, so by now it often seems like kind of a form of propaganda aimed at changing society's views of gender to me. I mean, my wife and I watch International House Hunters while we eat, and, you know, my gosh, the mix of couples that you see is not, I don't think, representative of the actual demographic mix of couples in the population as a whole. You know, for example, there's a very high percentage of gay couples of both genders, and nearly half, let's say, of the couples that are portrayed. And, you know, there are lots of mixed race couples, you know, which is fine. But I think to the number of them, the percentage of them there is much higher than is you can actually see in the population. So the media have a lot of influence in TV shows. What would you say about all of that? I'm sure you can add a lot to what I've just ranted on.
Yes and no. I would say that, yes, there are a lot more same-sex couples and interracial couples on television advertisements, television programs, magazines, and the culture at large. That being said, the number of same-sex and interracial couples has increased considerably over the past half century.
For sure.
And yeah. In certain segments of our society, particularly among Generation Z and millennial relationships, interracial marriage has increased considerably. Is it the majority? No. But it has considerably increased, as well as same-sex relationships.
Yeah, so I think everything you just said is true. But does it seem to you, as it seems to me, I think that TV kind of, like I said, propagandizes in a sense and sort of exaggerates those trends, maybe with an intention, a deliberate intention maybe on the part of producers of pushing those agendas forward. Would you say that's true? Does it seem that way to you?
Yes, I think a lot of times the media can have an agenda. And yes, I think that is the message they want to or intend to convey. And society is very receptive to advertising and media. It's a very seductive entity. And it certainly can be quite effective in motivating and forming public opinion.
Yeah, like, you know, you're mentioning TV ads. There's one that's been going on for a long time, the Sonic Drive-In ads. And there's two buddies, right? And so they're kind of like Abbott and Costello, with the one being an average but boyish kind of guy. And the other man is a complete fool. And, you know, he's kind of castigated by the more normal guy. But, you know, and that's kind of a common thing, you know, in a lot of ads. There used to be the cavemen on Geico ads, and they were clueless and buffoonish versions of men. You know, on the flip side of that, with women in ads, Flo, for example, on the Progressive insurance ads has evolved over time, I think, from, you know, she's been on for years and great gig she's had there, but from a very old-fashioned, smiling and ingratiating, silly me kind of image to a much more substantial character who, you know, really not so subtly makes fun of the simple-minded male customers very often. And so her role has changed in that ad, and I think has kind of reflected some of the changing in advertising just in the character of that one person on an ad. And a lot of cleaning product ads are still directed at women, as they used to be universally, right? But it's not entirely true anymore. And there are ads where a man is the one worrying about whether the detergent is getting the clothes clean enough and that kind of thing. That reflects reality, because many men get involved. I do, for sure, involved in you know, household chores of all kinds. I mean, it's just basically work. It's not, you know, man's work and women's work. It's just there's so much work to do, and who has the time to do it now? Or, you know, we divvy up the jobs and that's yours and this is mine or whatever. So anyway, you know, but I think ads, you know, as you were saying, media have a powerful kind of persuasion influence, you know, and again, you could call it propaganda if you want, but it's like that. Well, the internet has accelerated this trend tremendously toward the dissolution of gender boundaries. And while in some ways it's hardened them, you know, and made kind of contributed to the culture wars in a way where, you know, there's a kind of a backlash against some of the changes that are presented in more extreme forms in the internet. I mean, can you talk about that some?
I'd like to respond to your comment about changing norms with men being involved in housework. Okay. do believe that is a generational thing. Even in my generation, I'm a Generation Xer, and it was not unusual to hear guys of my generation talking about cleaning, washing the dishes, changing diapers, and such. You would not have heard that from men previous generations, maybe a few boomer men, but men of the silent generation, that was probably very unlikely.
Sure.
And I think as time has evolved, you see a fair amount of stay-at-home dads, Generation Xers, a few Generation Z, millennials. So with that, a lot of times the woman's income actually exceeds that of her husband or her partner.
Sure.
And because of that, a lot of times roles that were considered quote-unquote traditional, that would be subscribe to either men or women have sort of become more muddled. And, right. you know, as men take on roles that were largely seen as activities women performed. If you look at television shows today, cooking shows, for example, a large number of these hosts are men. When I was growing up, I think we had a show on PBS. I think her name was Julia Child.
Right.
And I think she came on once a week, and my mother would watch it every now and then, the show. Whatever it was, a pie, a roast, a pudding, potato, whatever the meal was that week, it was about an hour, and that was it. Now, you know, cooking shows, you see tons of guys, they're on location, you know, they're drinking beer in the process, they're playing music in the background, they're on the road riding with an entourage of people. There is that change of perception and what we saw decades ago. But even there is still in the backdrop with these cooking shows, these guys are still men.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think it hasn't totally been emasculated, but I do see an evolution that was not there decades ago.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, I'm a baby boomer, but I've always done the household chores. I mean, we do split up who does what for the most part, but we'll also pitch in and do the other ones, you know, in our household, whoever cooks, the other one washes, you know, so I end up doing the majority of the cooking because I'd rather do that than wash, you know, but we also within that divvy up, you know, if there's baking to be done, that kind of thing, generally my wife does it, but if it's grilling and stovetop cooking, I'll do that, you know, so it's kind of a subdivision of the subdivisions or whatever, but anyway, but you know, just a funny thing, my father, you were talking about the silent generation. So my father, who was, you know, a highly intelligent professional man, if he went into the kitchen, suddenly became like a bumbling idiot. It was like he hardly knew where the refrigerator was, hardly knew how to get a glass of water. And it was like he turned off his brain almost deliberately, almost, you know, because he felt like he was in an alien environment where that was not his sphere. And so he didn't want to display that he could actually function in there. So it was funny to watch him. Well, you know, but we started off though to talk about the internet and how I think it's kind of there's a backlash that's playing out every day in the culture war that's dividing, you know, the nation so sharply that we see. And maybe if I could put it in genderish terms, then in generalities, which are never true, but in large part, liberals are generally gender fluid, while conservatives are staunchly gender binary. And do you agree that's part of the clash of attitudes that we're seeing in our culture today?
Not necessarily. I would say it is more generational as opposed to ideological.
Okay.
By that, I mean, you'll find a lot of young conservatives who support gay marriage, young Republicans. Same thing with young Democrats and other liberals and progressives. However, I think with even older baby boomers, particularly people of the silent generation, even with the liberals, particularly Catholics, older blacks, Latinos, over a certain age, are more likely to be resistant to same-sex marriages. Probably more tolerant of interracial marriages, and that's tolerant, not accepting. Mm. To me, tolerance and acceptance are different.
Yeah.
So I think to me, I've been my experience and the research I have conducted, I would say sexuality is much more of a generational reaction as opposed to an ideological reaction.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think you're right. Yeah. So it kind of divides up more along those lines than on ideological lines. And maybe there's an overlap there probably, but you're right for sure.
I have nieces and nephews. They're adults now. The youngest two are in their 20s. But the ones who are in their 30s, they would talk about how Caitlin went to the prom with Jessica or Blake went to the prom with Matt. No big deal. In my generation in the 80s, that would have not have probably been the case. So I think when you're growing up, seeing those type of situations, it becomes more normal for you not to questioning it. This parent, this is a same-sex couple. This is an opposite-sex couple. Okay.
Yeah, I think you're right. In the late 60s, when I was that age in high school, they wouldn't have been allowed in the door of the prom. You know, but it's,
right.
and now it's no big deal. But yeah, I had a show recently, a two-part show on, we had three generations basically talking. I was the old guy, and then Generation X, and then a millennial, and we were talking about these kinds of things, and it was really breaking down very clearly along the lines you're talking about. Again, talking about race, Elwood, your book was published in 2011, and so during Barack Obama's first term, and in it there's a chapter which you and your co-author wrote on Obama's complicated and skillful navigation of the issues around his race, and even though it's past tense now, talk a little bit about what you observed then and thought about the way that Obama handled being biracial.
Sure. Obama was certainly aware of the dynamics of what biracial Americans endure. He is on the latter end of the baby boom generation. In fact, he would be what some people call the Joneses or the tweeners. And those are individuals born between 1958 to 1964. They're not Gen Xers, but they're really not hardcore baby boomers.
Yeah.
But they're the generation that makes the money, quite frankly. They got out of college during the Reagan years and early years and made quite a bit. Anyway, that I think he was shrewd enough, even though he grew up in Hawaii. That doesn't make Hawaiians less shrewd. Let's get that out the way. But he definitely was astute to the fact that society would see him as a black man, not necessarily a biracial man. Some argue that he is biracial, particularly on the right. When it's convenient for them to label him as black, he's black.
Yeah, right.
When it's convenient for them to label him as biracial, he was biracial. So he also knew he had to walk a fine line being the first black president of the United States.
Sure.
Therefore, he was very measured in his speech, how he addressed the issue of race, how primarily he was perceived. Some people look at his wife, Michelle, as kind of this powerhouse woman. She was kind of labeled unfairly, I would argue, as the domineering, angry, confrontational type of black woman who did not like white people and all this nonsensical allegations levied toward her. Obama talked about how, you know, it's one interview, how, you know, Michelle would require he would behave in this way or that way at times. And some people in the media took that as, you know, maybe he's a henpecked husband or maybe he's weak or, you know, it kind of tied into stereotypes or reinforced the assumption that she's the bossy, demanding, controlling black woman. And I think that probably was something she didn't like, but it also was told by him in a way to humanize him and to gain some degree of empathy for him to behave in the way he did. And that was not necessarily to challenge racial norms or to become seen himself as the angry black man who was confrontational.
Well, you know, my impression of her always was that she was a strong, highly intelligent, very well-educated woman. I think she was a Harvard Law School graduate, right?
And yes, she was. And Princeton, you know,
so basically they were just equals, and she had the full right to say what she thought, and so did he. And he was diplomatic. He was a nice guy, you know, but yeah, I didn't think he was knuckling under. I thought they just had a good, compatible partnership, seemed to me, and you know, I know that other people viewed it different ways, but that's what it clearly seemed like to me. But anyway, let's not go into too much more time because we are running short of time and talking about the Obama's marriage. Because it is past tense now as far as the national stage is concerned. But so, you know, we're talking here about masculinity overlapping with race, and I think it does in general to some extent. And just kind of briefly, Elwood, because we just have a minute or so left, but you talk, if we can do this in a minute or so, but you talk about the stereotypes in your book of good black man versus the bad black man, which are kind of harsh terms, but what's that about, just briefly? You know, it kind of ties into what we were just talking about with in the context of Barack Obama.
Yeah, the good black man is one who is about a larger society. I would say the conservative right, so to speak, and maybe the centrist and even neoliberals. He's one that's not confrontational. He doesn't rock the boat. He is well-groomed. He's sophisticated, well-spoken, intelligent, motivated, but not too ambitious or seen as too ambitious. And in some ways, knows his standing in society. Whereas the bad black man is one who is prone to criminality, outspoken, troublemaking, confrontational, rebellious.
Aggressive.
Yeah, you know,
scary.
Scary, you know, physically imposing,
right.
Those type of dynamics.
Very virile, very manly, right?
You know, right, part of the Mike Tyson image, Tyson. Mike Tyson personified the worst images that many whites across the political spectrum had about black men. He was, you know, apparently violent, sexually aggressive, you know,
potential dogfighting.
Exactly. I mean, he personified, you know, that as well. Now, prior to his allegations of murder, which he was found not guilty, but eventually was already, O.J. Simpson was seen as the good black man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was articulate, intelligent, and he was handsome, but he talked about race.
Yeah.
He made sure to speak in tones not to offend white sensibilities and the like. The late Colin Powell was seen as, you know, the good black man mm-hmm. by many, particularly mm-hmm. on the right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, you have different, Sidney Poitier, you know.
Yeah.
Prior to his problems, Bill Cosby.
I mean, those
individuals were seen as the, you know, the good black man. These are the kind of black men the other black men should aspire to be.
That's why it was so shocking in both the cases. I'm glad you mentioned that of O.J. Simpson and Bill Cosby. That's why it was so shocking how things turned out with them so suddenly, right? Because they went from being, as you say, the good black man to suddenly the bad black man. And it was like normally those two types were cast on two different ends of the football field. they weren't viewed as being interchangeable. And so suddenly both those cases, they went from one to the other. And that's why for white America in particular, it was very shocking. But,
well, Bill Cosby was seen as America's dad.
That's right.
So a black man had the title of America's dad. That in and of itself shows you how much he was revered.
Well, listen, Dr. Watson, we are going to have to leave it there. But again, the book we've been talking about is called Performing American Masculinities, The 21st Century Man in Popular Culture by L. Wood Watson and Mark Shaw. And actually, Dr. Watson's most recent book, published in September 2021, is titled Talking to You, Bro. I hope I'm getting that right. Talking to You, Bro, Liberate Your Mind from the Confusing, Ambiguous Messages of Contemporary Masculinity. And Elwood also wrote another one a while back called Pimps, Wimps, Studs, Thugs, and Gentlemen. I like that. Essays on Media Images of Masculinity. To buy any of these books that my guest has written on this subject and, you know, related subjects, probably the easiest thing to do is go to Amazon and search Elwood Watson, E-L-W-O-O-D Watson, under books. And they're all there. Well, Dr. Watson, it's been interesting. Thank you very much for being on with us.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.